Hey, everybody. Welcome again to F This Movie, the official podcast of FThisMovie.com. Movie love for movie lovers. My name is Patrick Browley, and I'm super excited for this week's show because we have a one-man vigilante here traipsing his way through Los Angeles on the quest for breakfast after 11 a.m. We're here to talk Falling Down, and I'm joined for this very special show by Anthony King. Hey, Anthony.
Hello, Patrick. Great to be back. I'm good.
Yeah,
I'm good.
Good to have you back. I used the word traipsing, and I regret it because I don't think at any point Michael Douglas traipses in this movie.
Wouldn't it be a completely different movie if he was traipsing or,
right?
frolicking,
Yes.
prancing across Los Angeles? I kind of went I don't want to say better movie, but it's a lateral move, I think.
Lateral move for sure. So we are going to talk Falling Down, which is a movie I have a weird history with, which I think I've told the story on this podcast, but if not, I'll tell it again when we get to it. But first, Anthony, have you seen anything good lately?
I have. We've been on a long weekend from school, so I have gotten to watch a ton of movies, all of which have I've enjoyed some a couple
oh, good.
rewatches, but every single one of them I liked, which is cool. So I finally dipped into I bought this Dirty Harry box set,
okay,
maybe 2 years ago, and I finally took the plastic off it. And I've seen all the Dirty Harry movies except for one, maybe. But anyway, so I wanted to start at the beginning. So I watched the original Dirty Harry movie, and it's, I still love it. It's, kind of sort of relative to the movie we're talking about today, I suppose.
I could see that, yeah.
But I really like it. I love Clint Eastwood. I understand why some people kind of have an allergy to Clint, and that's completely fine. But I like young man Clint. I like Clint in Italy. I like Clint in San Francisco. I like old man, Gran Torino Clint. I like all Clint. And it was a great rewatch. It's cool to see the influence, how much influence Dirty Harry has on so many other, kind of crime cop thrillers, mm-hmm. That came after. And the standout this time, and not that he hasn't, but I really sort of clung on to Andy Robinson's performance this time, and he is so scary in this movie. He is so scary. And my first I think probably time I ever saw Andy Robinson was probably in Hellraiser, and like he's really scummy in that. Mm-hmm. Already he doesn't mean to be. I bless his heart, I think he just kind of has that Weasley face. And his voice is kind of nasally, and it's like, this guy kind of rubs me the wrong way. Of course, when he, gets what's the uncle's name? Kind of
Frank.
The come to daddy is really icky, and I understand that's not really the character. That's not really dad. But then, in Charlie Varick, he's such a, and he's another weasel, kind of backstabbing guy in Charlie Varick. And, you love to see him get his comeuppance. And then here he is so scary. And, the part where he kind of has Clint running all over town with the bag of money. And then they finally meet at the base of the statue. And then Andy Robinson, beats the shit out of him, basically, and has him sort of at his, literally at his feet, is, I don't know, it's such a great performance. And Clint's sort of caricature, over the topness of that character of Harry Callahan. I feel like Andy Robinson's character, like his performance, like matches him. Like, you know, they're on an equal playing field, and it's not just Clint's movie. I feel like it's both of their movies. It's I will forever love that movie. Wait, I know you're a fan, right? You're a fan of Dirty Harry.
No, very much so. Yeah, I think I like all the Dirty Harrys. I don't know that I love the Deadpool, but I think that's the one I've seen the least.
Yeah, let's see. I have seen. The only one I haven't seen is The Enforcer.
Okay.
And
these just came up on a recent show, and I have been wanting to rewatch them all because of this conversation.
Yep,
and
which
now,
is why I cracked it open too.
Okay, this is making me want to watch it. Okay, so The Enforcer is the one with Tyne Daly. Is that the... No, Dirty Cops is the one, is the other one.
Is that Magnum Force?
That's Magnum Force.
One. Yeah, which I like. I think... I'm with you. I'm not a Deadpool fan.
Okay. And Sandra Locke is Sudden Impact, right?
Correct.
Okay.
And so, you know, Sudden Impact and Magnum Force for me are, you know, kind of equal. I mean, the original Dirty Harry is the one.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a big fan of Sudden Impact. That's a great 80s cop movie. You know, mm-hmm. It's very 80s, right? With sort of that Clint throwback to it. But yeah, it was a great revisit. So I'm going to start working my way through those.
It's wild to me that Dirty Harry is 71. I mean, that's practically the 60s.
Seriously. And it, you know how a lot of movies from early in a decade feel like a holdover, right?
For
from
sure.
The previous,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right. Especially yeah. If a movie from 1970 is a movie from 1968 or 69,
right,
ostensibly. So this one feels like it's sort of leading the charge of the 70s sort of crime exploitation movies, because it feels early, but it also feels a little cutting edge.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
So, big fan of Dirty Harry. I've also been watching a lot of Peter Yates movies.
Okay.
I don't know. Well, I know why. It's because last month
you got the bug from Krull.
From what? Oh, Krull.
last
the one
year's
Peter Yates
movie
I
list.
Don't like. Right. Yeah.
How
no,
dare
I,
you.
I know a lot of people are fans of that movie. I am not. It was fun to tweet through.
Yeah.
But, you know, I own it, I guess. So, there we go. There's that. That's the only Peter Yates movie I own.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Earlier this year, I had reviewed the Arrow disc of Murphy's War.
Right.
Starring Peter O'Toole, which is an early contender for top 10 discoveries for me.
Nice.
Great movie. It is so entertaining. Peter O'Toole is out of this world in that movie. And so I was like, you know what? I want to watch more Peter Yates because I'm a huge Bullet fan. Friends of Eddie Coyle, one of my all-time favorite movies.
Great movie.
So let me get in here real quick. I don't know if there's any other Peter Yates that it's Krull I saw for the first time last year. Oh, and then my favorite Peter Yates is The Hot Rock.
Yes, good one.
That's one of like the greatest heist movies, but it's such a great movie. So like between Bullet, Eddie Coyle, and The Hot Rock, it's like he might be one of my favorite directors because he doesn't have an extensive filmography. You know, I mean, it's 20, 25 movies maybe. Anyway, so I started, I watched last month or maybe 6 weeks ago, I watched The House on Carroll Street with Jeff Daniels, and it's okay. It's a 90s noir but set in the, you know, 40s or whatever. And it still felt Jeff Daniels is not a like he's not a period actor. You know, Jeff Daniels is, it's to me, seems like a very modern actor, right? Anyways, I liked it, but it wasn't the best. But the one that I, for some reason, I really wanted to see because I love her so much is Suspect, starring Cher and Dennis Quaid and Liam Neeson as a deaf, unhoused gentleman. And this, what a great fucking movie. I love this movie so much. Have you seen Suspect?
I'm not positive I have, because there's like three movies that came out around the same time and they all jumble up in my head. It's Suspect, Jagged Edge, and there's one more. Might be like In the Still of the Night, the Meryl Streep, Roy Scheider one.
Yeah.
They all exist as the same movie in my head. So I think I've seen, I know I've seen Jagged Edge, but I don't think I've seen Suspect.
Okay. Well, I have not seen Jagged Edge, but Suspect is leaps and bounds better than In the Still of the Night. I don't think In the Still of the Night is very good. I think Meryl is like on another, as much as I love her, she's on another planet in that movie. And Roy Scheider, it's like, you know, at later period, Roy Scheider, it's like, does he really want to be acting anyways? So anyway, Suspect, I love Cher, and 1987, this comes out, 1987 for Cher, Suspect, Moonstruck, and Witches of Eastwick.
Holy shit.
So obviously Suspect is the quote unquote lesser of the three, but the directors like Peter Yates, George Miller, and Norman Jewison, like in 1 year,
wow,
three pictures, like, you know, getting to work with those guys back to back to back is incredible. So Suspect, you know, it's a very convoluted story because there's so many different aspects going on. Cher is she's a public defender who is assigned to work the case of this murder case of a Supreme Court justice who had killed himself at the open. Like, that's how the movie starts. This guy shoots himself in the head, Supreme Court justice, and then his secretary is found murdered, and so they arrest this unhoused man played by Liam Neeson, who turns out to be deaf, and so he's like the prime suspect, and so Cher is assigned to the case to defend him. And you know, the first quarter of the movie is her like trying to figure out how to work with this guy. It's not revealed for like, you know, 20, 25 minutes that he's deaf. You just think this guy's crazy and he doesn't talk. So it's the first quarter of the movie is them trying to figure out how to work with each other. Then there's Dennis Quaid, who is this lobbyist, Washington, D.C. lobbyist for milk, for big milk. He's a lobbyist for Big Milk.
Big Milk.
I mean, watch out for those fuckers. and so he gets called in for jury duty. And so, like, when we're introduced to Quaid in this movie, again, I know a lot of people have an allergy to Dennis Quaid. I like him because,
yeah, me too.
Probably, you know, I watched a lot of his movies growing up. So, you know, it's just part of, you know, my childhood, I suppose. But I really like him. And so, like, when we're introduced to him, we think, like, you know, he's a lobbyist. He's kind of squirmy and weaselly, and maybe shady stuff is going on with him. You don't know. And so he gets called for jury duty. He gets picked to be on the jury of this this case. And then he starts his own investigation, which I guess you're not supposed to do if you're on a jury. And like, he's trying to help Cher out. And of course, she's like, no, you're going to like fuck things up here. Meanwhile, John Mahoney.
Okay.
Frasier's John. No, not Frasier. Striking Distance's John Mahoney. Right. Is that the Bruce Willis movie? Striking
it
Distance?
Is. Yeah.
Okay. He is the judge assigned to this case. And he, like, John Mahoney, as much as I love Frasier, and like, you know, I'm a big John Mahoney fan, but few men can be as much as an asshole as John Mahoney on film. And it's not like he played an asshole a lot of times. Spoilers for Striking Distance. But also, you know, he was in Say Anything, right?
Yeah,
he was
yeah,
the
yeah.
dad, you know. But here, oh, God, you know, it's such a good performance that I walked away. I was like, God, this guy's a fucking asshole. I hate John. Never going to be able to watch Frasier again. They have him wearing a skull cap, and so he's just got the crown of hair.
Okay.
And it looks very strange. He also has the it's not really a pencil thin, but it's a thin mustache right above the lip. You know, it's one of those where, you know, he obviously shaves right under the nose.
Right.
It's very strange looking. And so it took me a minute to get into his look, but he is such a sort of hard-nosed judge in this. And maybe he has something out for Cher. Maybe he doesn't. I don't want to spoil anything, but you know, the case is drawn out. There's a lot of like moving parts. So the script is sort of all over the place. None of that matters because the performances are incredible. Cher is awesome. Dennis Quaid is awesome. Liam Neeson doesn't have to talk, but he's, you know, he's really good in it. Mahoney, Joe Mantegna's in it.
Nice.
As the prosecuting attorney.
Oh, I'm sold.
Fred Melamed is like one of the, he's the guy who runs the public defender office. Bill Cobbs is one of the judges. I mean, like the people that show up in this movie, it's like, holy shit. Just
yeah.
One
Wow.
All these character actors. So, Suspect. So good. You know, it's a really generic title, but, you know, the movie is much better than its title. Speaking of a generic title and more Peter Yates, Eyewitness.
Yeah, I didn't. I was looking at his IMDb. I did not realize he did Eyewitness.
Neither did I until I cleared, you know, a month ago. I was sort of diving into his filmography. This one has been on my radar for a long time, and I love Sigourney Weaver.
Yeah.
I usually love William Hurt, you know, Christopher Plummer, James Woods.
Yeah.
Kenneth McMillan plays William Hurt's dad in this. Stephen Hill from Law and Order, a young Stephen Hill, although he doesn't look young. Morgan Freeman.
Yeah.
And Stephen Hill are like partners, the cops. Again, this is sort of a messy script, but I feel like Peter Yates's direction, and then, you know, he gets this incredible cast together. It's like, I don't really care about the story. I just want to spend time with these people, and he makes it look good. But, you know, there's a murder in a building, and William Hurt might be a witness. He might not be. Sigourney Weaver is a reporter that he's obsessed with. And so you have this kind of weird angle. And then you have Morgan Freeman and Stephen Hill being the cops that are surveilling the whole situation. James Woods is William Hurt's friend, and he's into some nefarious business. Again, lots of moving parts, but, you know, so many great characters that, you know, it's like, I want to spend time with these people. You know, I've probably talked about it before. James Woods, another one of those, not a great person, but God damn it. I really love his acting.
Absolutely.
God. And he is, you know, it's a young James Woods here. This is an early performance for him. And he's great. Christopher Plummer is like always menacing, but also charming. You know, it's like, what's the Canadian Daryl Duke film where it's Elliot Gould and Silent.
Oh,
it's the Christmas
the silent
movie.
partner.
Silent Partner. Thank
yeah,
you.
Yeah, yeah.
Where like Christopher Plummer is an absolute monster in that movie.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But you're also like, he's really charming because, you know, he's got like the eyeliner. He's cool, and he's weird and crazy. And anyways, so he's really charming in this, but maybe we shouldn't be charmed by him. I'm not going to spoil it. But it's, you know, this was another really fun movie from 1981. I'm glad I finally watched this. Have you seen Eyewitness?
I have. I remember it was a Pure Cinema recommendation years ago, and it, I think, was like streaming on Netflix at the time. So I happened to catch it, and I remember liking it, specifically the Sigourney Weaver stuff. And like you said, it's just one of those movies. Anytime you go back and watch a movie from this period, it's just like, look at all the people in this movie before they were famous.
Yeah.
But it's not streaming anywhere now, which is a bummer.
Yeah, because it was, I think it was probably put on my radar because of Pure Cinema.
Okay.
Also, and it was streaming like forever.
Yeah.
And it's like when you decide, okay, I'm going to sit down and finally watch this. Oh, you can't find it anywhere.
And there's no Blu-ray, right?
I don't think so, no.
Okay. Ugh.
Yeah.
Not cool.
Not cool. Hollywood, get on the Eyewitness.
Right?
Anyway, I'm not going to talk about it, but I also watched an early Peter Yates movie called Robbery from 1967. Again, these generic titles. You'll never guess what Robbery is about.
Is it about an eyewitness?
Yes. Yes, okay. It is.
All right, then.
And there are also suspects, and there is a robbery that happens. It's a, you know, these group of English criminals band together and they rob a train. You know, it's Money Train, set in England from 1967. And it's very, very good. But that is streaming on Canopy. So I do recommend that.
Okay.
The last one I'm going to talk about, and then I'll let you talk about the one that we both saw.
Oh yeah.
I had never, so we're talking about Joel Schumacher movie today.
Yeah, we are.
I had never seen 8mm. I thought I had.
Okay.
Never saw it. And so I watched it today.
Okay.
Early Sunday morning. It's a great Sunday morning.
Nice way to start the day.
Wow, watching this movie and like the kids are walking out of their bedrooms, waking up, rubbing their eyes, and here there's like snuff playing on my computer. And
yeah.
Woo. It's, let's see here. It's not good, but boy, did I love it.
I did not like this movie when I saw it in 99. I went to the theater to see it and I was like, Joel Schumacher is the wrong guy to try to make Seven. He's the wrong guy to do an Andrew Kevin Walker script.
Yeah.
It's like him trying to go dark and maybe he's not a dark guy. I've since revised my opinion, A, on Joel Schumacher, and B, on this movie, because then I watched it on Blu-ray a couple years ago, and I was like, oh, if I watch this as like a neo-noir, it's actually kind of awesome.
Yes. Yeah, I thought was weird, and he gets to the Nicolas Cage, like he gets all cagey, but like the first half of this movie,
yeah,
like nobody it like has any emotions, like everybody's playing it really low and slow, and like Catherine Keener never, I don't know what was going on there, like she, like the whole time I was like, I get really uncomfortable vibes from her performance, as much as I love Catherine Keener. Like whenever he would call her on the phone, be like, oh, how's the baby? Every time she would go, oh, she's sweet. I was like, yeah, not buying it. Nicolas Cage eventually, you know, gets the energy up, and you know, we get this, the typical Nicolas Cage performance of it all. I thought, I want to know where you stand on this. I still don't, after my first viewing, I don't know if Joel Schumacher was the guy to direct this movie. And also it felt like Andrew Kevin Walker was sort of in a rut, just is like, is this all he could write? 'Cause like he did Sleepy Hollow, and Sleepy Hollow is very good. And yes, dark, but like, not this or Seven, right? Or I just watched another Andrew Kevin Walker script where it's like, oh, it's more Fincher stuff. It's like, can't you do more, do something different? But I still loved it. Like, this is a 4 out of 5 stars for me. I still loved it.
Nice. Yeah. I have really come around on this movie. I really was kind of like not into it in 99, and now I'm, as much as you can like a movie like this, because it is Joel Schumacher kind of doing Paul Schrader's hardcore, right?
Right. Yeah, that's what I got more of, like Andrew Kevin Walker was like, oh, I'm going to write my hardcore.
Yeah. This, it seemed like a script that he like wrote before Seven got famous, and then they kind of dusted off when they were like, what else you got, Andy?
Right.
I got this 8mm thing laying around. You know, it's a little bit of that, like, shock me, shock me, shock me with that deviant behavior kind of a thing. But again, I think, you know, the cast, when you have a Catherine Keener who's just wasted in the wife role.
Yes.
But when your bench is that deep that you have Catherine Keener playing just wife, and you have Joaquin Phoenix, and you have Gandolfini, right? And you have, who's the guy that's... Stormare is great. I can't think of Norman Reedus shows up.
Yeah, Norman Reedus, yeah.
There was somebody else that I was trying to think of. Oh, Machine.
Oh, yeah, Chris Bauer.
Chris Bauer, no, yeah, there we
yeah,
go.
Yeah, Chris Bauer. And, I mean, like, Anthony
From
Held.
From The Wire. Yeah,
right?
Anthony Held,
yeah. Anthony Held. Like, yeah, the cast is ridiculous. And I think that speaks to people. And I don't know a lot of his history. I just discovered today Joel Schumacher was gay. I didn't know that. Not that it, you know, that makes any difference.
Had you not seen his Batman movies?
That's... You mean the gay one? Both right. of the gay ones? Yes.
Exactly.
Yes. Yeah, you know, the, and so like when I read that before I started watching 8mm, and I was like, oh God, what kind of shit is Joel Schumacher into? Like, what kind of, you know, bondage stuff? Again, that's whatever, you know, have your kink. That's fine. I'm also into some weird things. But you know, I liked how dark it got. And you know, it's, I suppose it's a happy ending, but it's also like one of those, like, how do you recover
exactly
from going through this? Right.
Right.
And you know how much I love an ending like that.
Yeah.
I love a downer of an ending. And, but yeah, like these people show up, like, cause I try not to pay attention to even the casting at the beginning. Cause I didn't know anything about this movie other than I knew it was him discovering like something about a snuff film. And so like when Joaquin Phoenix shows up, I'm like, what the fuck? Holy shit. And he's great. He's so good in this.
Yeah.
And you know, and then, God, Peter Stormare is like, again, how I was talking about how Andy Robinson kind of like met Clint at his right at his level in Dirty Harry, like Peter Stormare and Nicolas Cage are like off the charts crazy. Where like Nicolas Cage, you know, he's more vocal, but like Peter Stormare, just his, I don't know, the way he kind of held his body, and like he would have these pauses when he speaks, it's just very disturbing. And so it was, you know, it was a great match for Nicolas Cage, but you know, I dug it a lot. Really like this movie, and it's one of those, I understand how people would be like, oh, you know, it's a one and done for me, but I'm like, I could see myself rewatching this quite often.
I've watched it like 4 times just since liking it again, so
right?
I've
yeah.
seen it probably 5 times now. Yeah, 99 was such a good year that even the bad movies rule. Even 8mm is like, nope, pretty good,
right? Yep. So that's what I got.
All right, very nice. Well, I'll start with the one that we both saw, because we both went to the theater this weekend and saw the new Rose Glass movie, Love Lies Bleeding, which I don't know, like, what else is coming out this year even, but since I saw the poster, has been my most anticipated movie of 2024. Kristen Stewart plays an employee at a gym who takes notice of a new gym member, sort of, or just a girl who's there working out, played by Katie O'Brien, who has been in stuff. I guess she was in Quantumania, which I saw, but I don't remember. And she's on The Mandalorian, which I didn't watch. I feel like if she didn't exist, Rose Glass would have had to invent her to be in this movie.
Yeah, she's the only, it seems like she's the only person. When Bobby and I walked out of the theaters, like, there was nobody else.
How did you find that? Right. Like, how did you know writing this movie that Katie O'Brien existed? And maybe they did. I have no idea. I don't know the behind the scenes, but like, to know that there's somebody who's like a female bodybuilder, who's this charismatic, who's going to have this kind of chemistry with Kristen Stewart, who's this talented of an actor. She has to check a lot of boxes, and she really does. So it becomes, you know, again, neo-noir kind of being the theme of these, what have you seen lately, or have you seen anything good lately? Very much a neo-noir. I don't even want to say really what the rest of the movie is about, except the two of them get involved in a possible crime. I kind of not totally joked on Twitter that it's a combination of Bound and Pain and Gain and Punch Drunk Love, because I think there's a real element. The thing I love about Punch Drunk Love is the weird abstractions that Paul Thomas Anderson includes, where it's like, this is what being in love feels like. And Adam Sandler's whole speech about, like, it gives me what, I don't remember, the, I have a love in my life and it makes me strong or something. I mean, there's throughout the movie, there are hints of that kind of thing. Every time they show her hulking out or whatever, you're just like, yeah, this is love making her strong. Right. And so, God damn, did I love this movie?
Yeah. I haven't seen Pain and Gain or Bound.
Oh my gosh, Bound is coming out from Criterion.
I know,
announced the day that I saw Love Lies Bleeding. Right. I was like, well, this is perfect. Bound is so good.
But I completely understood the Punch Drunk Love, where like the love that is explored in that movie is like this, it's just so pure and genuine that it's hard to, like, the only way to experience it is to experience it, like you can't put words to it, you can't show it, and I feel like Paul Thomas Anderson does that as best he can in his films, you know, that, and then I think what's the dresser one?
Phantom Thread,
thank you. Like, are two that like explore love in its purest form,
yeah,
where you just don't get it unless you've been there, right?
Sure. Yeah.
So I get that in relation to Love Lies Bleeding, where I completely buy the love these two people have for each other. It's messy and it's weird, and like, you know, there's times where you almost feel, again, it's not the right word, but like it's like a feeling of hatred that boils up. Like you love this person so much that when they make you mad, it's like you've never been as mad as ever, right? Mm-hmm. In that moment. And I feel like Rose Glass nailed it completely. And then she had these two people who were able to perfectly portray it. I was not a super huge fan of Saint Maud.
I thought it was okay.
You know, it was fine. You know, it's like one of those where, you know, it just kind of falls on Shudder and then it just lives there forever. You know, one of those types of movies. And then, like, I really did not like the ending of Saint Maud. And I like an abstract ending, like mm-hmm. a weird ending. I like mm-hmm. a sad ending. You know, I don't love a neat button. I usually don't like or want a button on my movie. And she doesn't put buttons on her movie. But I don't know if she 100% stuck the landing with Love Lies Bleeding as much as I loved this movie. But that just because I didn't love the ending of, and not the very ending. It's the thing, you know, when, right, you know what I'm talking about, right? Sort of like the fantastical part, where Bobby's like, what is going on here? And I was like, oh, I get it. Like, I saw Saint Maud. I get it. Okay.
I'm very curious to see how people, as more people see this movie, how people are going to react to that moment. Because talk about a filmmaker willing to just fucking go for it.
And you know what? As much as I was like, you know, she's doing her thing again. and I don't have to love it. I also wanted to stand up and be like, yes, do your thing. Yes, go.
Exactly.
You know,
right.
But holy shit, I, you know, I love this movie so much.
Yeah.
Ed Harris is, you know, I mean, are we allowed to say Ed Harris? Well, it's too late. Ed Harris is in this movie.
Yeah.
Fucking awesome. So good.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, everybody, Dave Franco, Jenna Malone, like the people in this movie, like it's one of those where every single person is like the only person that could play that role, right? And it just lines up for every, and like I love Dave Franco, and I like Dave Franco in sort of like the mumblecore Dave Franco, where it's, you know, more like, oh, likable Dave Franco, but wow, what a piece of shit. And you know, just the places this movie went, again, I had never seen a trailer, I'd never read a synopsis, I just knew the poster, and I knew Kristen Stewart was in it. And so we went in, and you know, like I said, we, Bobby and I both came out and we're like, oh my god, it's so good. Now, the joke was, I wasn't planning on watching any 2024 releases this year, which is
okay,
complete bullshit, but you know, that was the joke between Bobby and I. And she's like, oh, we had a night, you know, where it was just us, and I was like, you want to go to a movie? She's like, is that going to break your rule? And I'm like, oh, I really want to see this movie.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's this, and like, you know, the trailers that played before, the only other one I want to see is the Monkey Man, you know, the Indian John Wick.
Yeah.
One, you know, they played Civil War, which I love Alex Garland and that looks incredible, but no thanks. Like, we're too close to actually living
that.
So I don't want to.
Going to be a tough watch.
Right? Like, it's the same reason I don't watch Handmaid's Tale.
Right.
it's too scary. It's too close. It's too real. No thanks.
I was so relieved because I went to see Dune Part 2 2 weeks ago, and every trailer was IP. It was Planet of the Apes. It was Godzilla Kong. It was Twisters. It was Furiosa. It was Quiet Place. Like 8 or 9 of them. And every single one was based on something else. And I got very depressed about the state of modern movies, even though Dune Part 2 is very good. So it was nice to go see Love Lies Bleeding. And every trailer was something original.
Yes.
Even though most of them I wasn't excited to see.
Right.
I still am just glad that we're still making movies.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. You know, like Bobby, she really wants to see the Amy Winehouse movie. I didn't even know they were making one. You know, not my thing, but like, again, like it's not a previously, right. It's not IP.
Right.
So that's cool. The other thing, we also loved about Love Lies Bleeding, it's under 2 hours.
Yeah.
Right. Like I have nothing against long movies. I love a long movie. You know, Bellatar, I'll sit down and watch Satan Tango. No problem. 8 hours. Count me in. But also I love an economical 106 minute movie. That was cool too. It's, you know, we got out, in time to go get some ice cream. Right. And like go home, and I had time to watch another movie.
Nice. What'd you watch? Yeah. How do you follow Love Lies Bleeding?
Peter Yates, robbery.
Oh, of course.
Yeah. And Bobby's like, I don't want to watch this. And she went to bed. Anyways. Okay. Go ahead.
No, nothing. My crush on Kristen Stewart is well documented, and I've had a crush on her for many, many years, not just because she's a great actor and not just because she's a babe, but also because so much of it is because she makes shit like Love Lies Bleeding, where it's just like, oh, God bless you for being willing to be a freak and like appear in these crazy ass movies and not just, you know, because there was that period around Twilight where they were really trying to make her mainstream and they put her in Snow White and the Huntsman and they put her in, there's another one around that time where it's like, and she kind of rejected that. Robert Pattinson did kind of the same thing, and he can bounce back and forth, and so can she. He can be in Batman and then he can be in Good Time, you know?
Yep.
And she's kind of the same way. I love, they were such punching bags when Twilight was out, and they've revealed themselves to be two of the best actors of their generation, and they have amazing taste, and they work with all these great artists, and they're always good. I'm so excited anytime one of them shows up in something.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, I look at where they came from, Robert Pattinson and Kristen Stewart, to where they are now and the choices that they've made.
Yeah.
Just incredible stuff. And every now and then do one of those paycheck movies and then get out there and make Personal Shopper.
Right.
Make a Love Lies Bleeding, make a Good Time. And they can show they're more than like these quiet, awkward characters that dominated the world for so long.
Right.
You thought, oh my God, is this all these people can do? No, obviously not. Kristen Stewart is such a good actor that like she convinced the world with her performance, like, oh, this is how I really am.
Right. Right.
No, you watch the movie she's in, and like she's not like that. She can play awkward really well because she's a great fucking actress.
So I got home from Love Lies Bleeding and definitely wanted to rewatch Pain and Gain because I haven't seen it since the theater, and I know that it has fans on Twitter. And my reaction in the theater was, going into it, I was like, this seems like the movie that's going to prove to me that Michael Bay is a real filmmaker is dismissive. He's obviously a real filmmaker, but he was only making a certain kind of movie, and Pain and Gain seemed like it was going to be a break, and it was like, I'm going to make this other kind of thing and I'm perfectly suited for it. And truth be told, he was, but I didn't love the movie when I saw it in whatever year it was, 2013 or something, because I kept butting up against the racism and homophobia and fat phobia and misogyny of the shit that's in every Michael Bay movie. And anyway, I rewatched it. Maybe knowing what I was in for helped. Maybe I was trying to buy into what some of the defenders say, which is that like, that shit is in there because it's the worldview of these characters. It's real sticky because I'm like, yeah, I would agree with that if every other Michael Bay movie didn't have the same worldview. Sure. But I liked it way more than I did. And I'm glad that I have the rule of never give up on a movie, because I would never have gone back to see Pain and Gain again. And I think there's a lot to really like in that movie. Yes, there's the shit that I just mentioned, that if you can't get past that, I don't blame you, because that's the Michael Bay of it all. But like, he's a good director. He's got a great eye. The story is much more interesting than, you know, Transformers 4. The cast is really strong because he just lifts everybody from Coen Brothers movies, basically. Mark Wahlberg, you know, is doing Mark Wahlberg. But it's actually maybe my favorite Dwayne Johnson performance. And it's kind of like in that zone right before he became Mr. Hollywood, where he can only make these shitty four quadrant, like, sure, has to be successful globally. And he's so cynical about the kinds of movies that he'll make. He refuses to take any chances. And in Pain and Gain, he still was kind of taking a chance, and it really pays off. He's really, really good in the movie. It's totally worth seeing if you like or hate Michael Bay movies.
Yeah, I've never seen it. A guy I used to work with swore by it. It was his all-time favorite movie. And I'm like, oh,
that
course.
Is telling.
Of course. And, yeah. That's... like, yeah. And, you know, this dude's name was Vinny. I was like, yeah, of course. Yeah. Your favorite movie is Pain and Gain. Again, I knew nothing. I know nothing about it. And, you know, to be honest, I've only seen, you know, The Rock, which I love.
Yeah, it's great.
Ambulance, which I loved.
Very good.
Armageddon, which I despise. I think that's one of the worst movies ever made.
Oh, nonsense.
TBQH. And that's it. Like, I've never seen Bad Boys or Bad Boys 2. I've never seen any of the Transformers, which I'm not interested in the Transformers movies. I am interested in the Bad Boys movies and Six Underground, Pain and Gain. I'll watch The Island, 13 Hours. Seems cool. Yeah. So, like, I'm not a big, like, I don't know much about Michael Bay or his movies. I'm not a, what do they call him on Twitter? Bayniacs? Bayheads?
Oh, that's, I think it's just Bayhead, but Bayniacs is probably a better name.
It should be Bayniacs. Come on.
Yeah, right. Come on.
Obviously, these are people who watch Michael Bay movies.
It was right there, guys.
Yeah. Leave it to the guy that watches Peter Yates movies. Come on.
I think as a cop movie fan, there's stuff to that you'll like in the Bad Boys movies.
I'm sure, yeah.
Pain and Gain, very much worth seeing. I think you can safely skip the Transformers movies. They don't do anything for me.
Yeah.
Other people love them, I know. I don't know. It was fascinating. I wrestle with it. And this will come up again, by the way. And then the last movie that I'll talk about is I rewatched Sean Penn's The Pledge because I've still been on a little bit of a Nicholson kick. And I don't think I had seen it since the theater when I was like, that was okay. I think I remember liking his performance and not thinking much of the movie. Once again, glad I don't give up on movies because The Pledge is pretty amazing and belongs very much in the 1970s. Sean Penn does a couple things camera-wise that I don't love. If he didn't, I would be much closer to being like, it's a near-perfect movie. He plays a guy who is – he's a retiring police officer who – there's shades of 8mm, to be honest, because a little girl gets murdered. It's hard to watch. They don't show the murder, but they do show, spoilers, the body, and it's hard to watch. I mean, this is a difficult movie because it is just mired in people's pain and trauma. So he goes to the murder scene, sees what happened, talks to the mom, played by, oh my gosh, I'm blanking on her name.
Patricia Clarkson.
Everybody in this movie is somebody. They come for one scene and they just fucking knock it out of the park and then they disappear from the movie.
14 names down is like somebody.
Yeah. Helen Mirren is a therapist for one scene.
Oh my God.
Mickey Rourke comes in as the dad of a missing girl and gives the best performance he's ever given in one scene and makes you cry and completely devastates you. He's unreal. And then Nicholson is the fucking man holding it all together. So he promises Patricia Clarkson, I'm going to find the person that did this, basically. Now, there is some hashtag problematic stuff.
Sure.
Because Benicio del Toro shows up in this movie as both an indigenous man, which he is not, and a special needs man, which he is not. And so,
come on, brother. Why is he always doing this?
2001 was a different time, and they would have found a different actor. I mean, Benicio del Toro is a great actor. They would have found a different actor if this movie were made in 2024. So there's definitely some stuff where you're like, oh, that doesn't fly anymore. But of course, if you can take a movie in the spirit in which it was made at the time at which it was made, we can all be adults and get past that stuff. I thought this movie was so fucking good. I don't know what was wrong with me when I saw it in 2001 that I was like kind of indifferent towards it. But man, I really – and I only watched it again because like 6 months ago, I was at Half Price Books, and it was there's a DVD snap case on the clearance rack for $2.
Nice.
And I was like, well, that's worth seeing again for $2. And I love a snap case.
Yeah.
So I picked it up, and I'm so glad I did, because I really want this movie in my collection.
Cool. Yeah, this, you know,
it's some real Sad Vember shit, just so you know.
Good. We love a sad movie. Yeah, I mean, just like Aaron Eckhart, Robin Wright, Sam Shepard, Mickey Rohr, Vanessa Redgrave, Lo Smith, Eileen Ryan, Kostas Mandalur,
yeah,
Harry Dean Stanton, Tom Noonan.
Yeah.
Like, what the fuck?
Some of these people have eight lines. Harry Dean Stanton, if he has eight lines of dialogue, I'd be surprised.
Yeah. Yeah, that's incredible. Well, you know, that's, again, people wanting to work maybe with Sean Penn, work with, you know, a chance to appear in a movie with Jack Nicholson.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, this is, again, been on my radar, and I've known nothing about it, but, you know, I know the poster more than anything, right, of his mustachioed face, you know, grimacing. I mean, sounds like something I'm totally into.
Yeah. A lot of solid recommends in the have you seen anything good lately section of the show this week. But let's move into our main topic. Joel Schumacher's Falling Down from what, 92?
93.
Jesus. Okay.
February release. 93. It's a February dump. It's not, this does not feel like a February movie.
So it must have been an unseasonably warm February, because my story about this movie is I saw the trailer, and for whatever reason, like, imprinted on this movie in such a big bad way, I was so determined to see it. I did not drive yet. I didn't have friends who drove. So I walked about 2 hours to the mall, which was the next town over, to see this movie with a friend, without considering the fact that when we got up to the ticket window, the man would say, well, this is rated R. Do you have adults here? And we just had to lie and be like, they're already inside. And luckily he went for it, because he let us in. Because if we had walked 2 hours to be turned away from Falling Down, I would have been devastated. So the fact that it came out in February surprises me, because I don't remember like bundling up to walk to the Woodfield 1 and 2, but we sure did. And it was not the movie that I was sold in the trailers.
So I... same experience. Saw the trailer and I was like, oh, this movie is for me. You know, and I mean, 11-year-old Anthony, this movie's for me. This movie is definitely for 11-year-old boy. And you know,
I was maybe 13. What the fuck was wrong with us? Why did we think Falling Down was speaking to it? This man wants breakfast and it's after 11. This is a frustration I can relate to.
I think, okay, so like how Dennis Quaid was for some reason part of my childhood. We watched the Joe Dante movie,
Inner Space,
constantly, you know, a couple times a week. So maybe that's all the Dennis Quaid I had in my life. Still, it was a lot of Dennis Quaid. I feel like Michael Douglas was also a huge part of my life. Michael Douglas, not like a family known for his family films. I will say though, when we first got a VCR, so this is how we got our first VCR, one of the Pop Top VCR back in maybe 89, must have been 89. My dad had to trade a brand new unopened box of Bowman baseball cards for a used Pop Top VCR to a family friend. And I remember, it was like 8 or 9 o'clock at night. We all had to get in the car and drive to Jeff worked. He was a thrower at UPS. And so he was working that night. We had to get in the car at like 9 o'clock at night and take Jeff his box of baseball cards. So we could get the VCR. And so the first three tapes, and for God knows how long, because tapes were so expensive back then to purchase. The only tapes we had were Ferris Bueller's Day Off,
Yep.
Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade,
Okay.
and Fatal Attraction.
Naturally.
My brother and I watched the shit out of Ferris Bueller and Indiana Jones. And of course, my parents were like, "Oh, you cannot watch Fatal Attraction," which made me want to watch Fatal Attraction even more.
Of course.
And so I watched not all of it, but some of Fatal Attraction. I was like, "I love this movie." 7 years old, I was like, "Yeah, Fatal Attraction, one of my favorites." And so I mean, it felt like for 2 years, maybe those were the only tapes we, of course, we would rent tapes from the mom and pop down the street, but we always had those three tapes in the house. One of mom's favorite movies was Romancing the Stone, so I'm sure we rented Romancing the Stone all the time. I haven't watched it since back then. What else? I don't know. Maybe my parents were into The Streets of San Francisco and they watched it syndicated. I don't know. Like, why was Michael Douglas in my house so much? I have no idea. It just felt like he was. So seeing the trailer for Falling Down, I'm like, holy shit, Michael Douglas looks totally different, like with the flat top and the glasses. I'm like, oh my God, this has got to be my new favorite movie. And of course I was 11. I didn't walk 2 hours to go see it. I didn't see it till the Snapcase DVD came out, whenever, 96, maybe 97. And that's the first time I watched it. And I was like, yeah, this is the movie that I wanted. And it has always been the movie that I wanted up until when I watched it yesterday, where it slipped just half a star.
Interesting. I wonder why.
So I love Falling Down. I think it's Michael Douglas's best performance. I don't think anybody else is good, and that's the half star. Like, the other performances are terrible in this movie, I think. All of them.
I don't think
I think Robert Duvall is, I mean, he's doing something. And I guess Tuesday Weld also is like, she's going, for the rafters also. But Robert Duvall's doing something here. But I think Michael Douglas is out of this world in this movie.
He's good, and it's fascinating that this is the movie he makes after Basic Instinct. Like, that movie, cements his status as like leading man, especially of like sexy thriller. And he's like, what's the least sexy thing I can do? I know.
Right. Well, because, like, you and I, we did an episode on Basic Instinct, and we
Yeah.
talked about sleazy Michael Douglas, the slick back hair, Fatal Attraction, Wall Street, Black Rain,
Yep.
another movie I absolutely love.
Yeah, it's a good one.
War of the Roses, more funny than not, Basic Instinct. But yeah, and then, like, completely, and I don't know if he was like, I need an image change. I can't imagine Michael Douglas was like, I need an image change, because I think he's perfectly happy with his image. But he does Falling Down, and then, of course, like, right after goes to Disclosure, like back
Right,
to
right,
sleaze.
right.
I don't know, man. Like, I really love Michael Douglas, which is like, he's not one of, he's not a guy where people are like, oh yeah, Michael Douglas is one of my guys. I don't know if he's one of my guys, but, like, he's like one of my top 20 favorite actors.
Yeah.
Maybe top 15. And this is my favorite Michael Douglas performance.
I cannot get a handle on how I feel about this movie. Like, because again, when I wanted to see it so badly, it's because I really thought it was about a guy who's just fed up with the way that the world is and is going to fight back, you know,
like a one-man army sort of thing.
Not even like a commando situation, but just again, the scene in the fast food place was so heavily featured in the marketing where it was like, I want breakfast, but it's after 11. Dee Dee Pfeiffer working the register, by the way, love Dee Dee Pfeiffer. And I was like, yeah, finally someone gets it. Again, I don't know why I was so frustrated with the world at this age, but that's what I thought the movie was. So then I go to see it and it's fucking Taxi Driver. And I'm like, I'm not ready for this. I'm not equipped for like this weird leftover relic of the 1950s who can't grasp the world today. And it's the pain and gain thing where it's like, is this movie, again, depiction is not endorsement.
Right.
But this movie, I think, vacillates pretty wildly between commenting on racism and ugliness and being ugly and racist.
Right. Yeah, it's, you know, like I wrote about in my latest Cult Corner about Fight Club.
Yeah.
How this time around, like, it's all I read in Fight Club was the satire.
Yeah.
You know, all I read in Falling Down this time was the satire. But it's like you're saying, it's inappropriate satire. Like, do we need to be satirizing this stuff? And the answer is no. I think we, you know, the issues that are being explored in this movie maybe need a harder, more serious look. But you know, it still hits for me for some reason, because the funny parts, like I was rolling like tears down my, like, you know, you forgot your briefcase, I think is so goddamn funny. And the funniest moment in this movie, and here's the funny thing, like this movie like explores, it goes through the gauntlet of emotions where it's like one of the saddest movies in the world. It's one of the funniest, and like, it's one of the, like, you know, angriest, you know, whether it's, you know, it's anger on the screen or making you feel angry. But I think the part where he has the bazooka and he accidentally shoots it underground, is hysterical. And I think those moments, if they're not in this movie is way too heavy and then becomes like, oh, is this a racist? I think this is a racist, like, hate filled movie. Like,
it kind of is.
Something like Dallas would, whatever the fuck his last name is, would put out, you know, the
oh yeah, yeah,
campfire,
yeah,
old guy, whatever the fuck his name
yeah,
is.
Yeah. I know who you're talking about.
Right.
Your former boss.
My former boss, exactly. And again, like, I'm not gonna be like, oh no, this movie is not racist. Cause like, yeah, there are some really inappropriate moments in this movie. But you know, it's just one of those things. And I don't think I don't have any like nostalgia wrapped up in it, because I watch this movie a lot, like once a year.
Okay.
Again, I don't know why. You know, when the critic for the AV Club, Natasha, podcast. Anyways, like,
son of a bitch, I can't remember.
She went back and rewatched it a few years ago and was like, oh, this is not, this movie is dangerous. Like, it's promoting dangerous ideas and stuff. And I don't think that's the case.
Tasha Robinson, sorry.
Natasha Robinson, there we go.
Yeah, yeah.
Who I love. I really love her writing.
Yeah.
But I disagree. I don't think this movie is promoting anything other than, you know, it's a movie. And it's weird, like, you know, it's written by Ebby Rose Smith. His only other writing credit, or did he write it or direct it? Yeah, Car 54, Where Are You?
Which I haven't seen. I missed it out. I missed out on it during 94 month.
Oh gosh. So yeah, I it feels okay. If you consider, this is what I kept thinking of. Like LA Confidential, Dark Blue, Black Dahlia, James Ellroy, right? He seems like a very angry man, but I love James Ellroy. I love his books. And they are filled with, it's almost one of those, like, is he just using this as an excuse to get out some of his hatred or anger or whatever? That's how I feel about Falling Down. Ebby Rowe Smith, not y there's not much to know about him. Maybe because he was a hate-filled man and no one wanted to work with him. Who knows? I don't know that. I doubt that. So that's kind of how I view Falling Down. It's comparable for me to like an Elroy.
It's such a weird outlier in Joel Schumacher's filmography because I genuinely do not believe him to be an angry or hate-filled person at all. He's a lovely man who's filled with compassion. And I feel like the messaging of the movie, or he saw it more as this kind of psychological drama. And part of it is being a product of its time. There's not a lot of depictions of early 90s Los Angeles that aren't filled with like Mexican gang members. And I'm surprised there aren't like Jamaican drug dealers in this movie because it's the Predator 2 of it all, you know? But I feel like he doesn't ever totally get a handle on the movie that he's making. And I think it's a fascinating movie. I think it's very much worth watching. And I think it's a challenging movie, especially for a major studio to put out. I think that it has so much going for it, including the Michael Douglas performance. It doesn't fit like 8mm. It doesn't fit within what I find a Joel Schumacher film to be. And I think some of the anger and the racism and that those qualities of the film end up in there unintentionally, which, you know, you could say like he can't be blamed for it, or you could say like, well, you accidentally made a racist movie. Again, I think he was really trying to sort of protect himself or hedge his bets. The whole Frederick Forrest scene seems to be in the movie as a response to those potential accusations, right? That it's like, okay, yeah, defense is bad, but he's not this guy. And so, see, I'm not a racist. I'm not homophobic. I'm not a monster. Frederick Forrest is the monster. I'm just a guy who's out of time. But it's not even that movie because he's clearly has mental illness too. So it's like, it can't. I don't think it ever fully decides who defends is, which on the one hand makes it fascinating, but on the other makes it deeply flawed.
Now, here's the thing. Every time I watch this movie, I float between the clouds of sympathy or empathy for defense
Sure.
and condemnation for every. Basically for his existence. Like how, I hate referring to it again, but my recent rewatch of Fight Club, how I saw so much of it is like it's Gen X people responding to boomers. I look at Falling Down as I don't know if it's where is it lying, pro wise? Like, are we supposed to like feel empathy for defense? That's what I'm like my constant question every time I watch this. Like, am I supposed to feel empathy for defense. And ultimately, I do. Like, at the end, obviously, this is a very mentally sick individual, and he needs help. And they say that in the movie a couple times. But at the end, when he says, I'm the bad guy.
Sure.
And the line reading is so good. Douglas is so good in that moment where I completely believe that he has no idea. Like, he doesn't get it. This man just does not understand, like, oh, he's, am I actually the bad guy? Which then speaks to like how sick he really is. He has, you know, he doesn't, he, you know, it, does he even know what he's been doing all day? Probably not, you know. It's, you know, he's living moment to moment. And then as soon as that moment passes, he completely forgets it. He moves on to the next moment. And then by the end of the day, if you'd say, what'd you do today? Would he just say, oh, I just drove here to my daughter's birthday. I was trying to get to my daughter's birthday. What happened? Heavy traffic, you know. Would he even realize what right. he did? And there's, you know, within his traipsing, like he has these moments where it's like Schumacher is not trying to get us on his side, but to show the humanity of this character. And for me, it's hard, like, not to, like, I can't ignore the humanity of even a terrible character like Defense.
Sure.
You know, the, when he crashes the pool party, you know, it's like, he's holding that girl's hand, not like, he doesn't even realize, like, oh, he's, it looks like he's holding her hostage. Like, he realizes, oh God, he's bleeding on her. He's like, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry, honey. Are you okay? And like, again, like, Douglas is so good in that moment where like, oh God, I like this guy. He needs help. Like, somebody needs to help him, but he, like, he's carrying this fucking arsenal around. Like, how are you supposed to approach this man now? And I do love Duvall in this movie. You know, I don't know if he's good or not, but I still love him in this movie. I'm a Robert Duvall fan, and I love their meeting at the end. Like, this whole movie, these two characters have been converging, and it's not till the very end till they finally meet. And it's a wonderful meeting. Like, this performance, these performances from both of them, I think it works really well. And the way Duvall's character, like, approaches Defense, he doesn't want to shoot this guy. He realizes this guy, more than anything, needs help. He needs to go to a hospital, and he needs to, you know, be under psychiatric care and all that. And so, like, throughout the movie, I find myself like, oh God, this guy's a monster. But is he? He's still a person, you know? And I think that's sort of genius the way.
Yeah, no, that's definitely a credit to Schumacher and to the movie.
Right.
It's also a testament to the movie that, again, the cast is as deep as it is. Like, you don't need Tuesday Weld in this movie. You don't need Barbara Hershey in this movie. I'm not even positive you need Robert Duvall in this movie. Like, yeah. What is the function of that character except to, like, pad out the story?
It does feel like a lot of this stuff is just padding. Like, the scenes in the police station in their little squad room are almost excruciating to watch because, A, I think the performances are not great.
D.W. Moffat clearly just playing Bill Paxton, right? In Predator 2, not to bring that movie up again, right. But
and it's like, oh God, like, do we have to, like, we get, like, this retirement thing. The other thing, like, with, and I love Tuesday Weld. Again, it's like, are not saying we're wasting Tuesday Weld because I think her performance is really good here. But are we trying to show her as, like, this, you know, oppressive wife character, or are we trying to show her as, like, is she a woman who's sick And like
that, that's always been my read, is that she too. Has illness. Yeah.
That she has an illness.
Yeah.
But for some reason this time around, I'm like, oh, are they showing her just as like the bitchy wife?
No, I've always taken it as she's ill. Robert Duvall knows that, which is partly why he gets so pissed off at D.W. Moffat at the end of the film when he finally makes a crack about her. But like, but why is that in the movie?
Exactly.
Why is any of it in the movie? I think it's compelling. I enjoy the Robert Duvall performance. I think the story about the cop on his last day is interesting. He's got a wife who's sick. He maybe has had an affair with his partner.
See, that's the other thing. It's like they hint.
Right. At,
and again, I'm not a child. I don't need to be spoon-fed every little thing. But the way that the affair thing and then is his wife sick or not are hinted at, I feel like we either need a little more or you just cut it. Right? Like cut the, and you know, it would just be a few lines of dialogue, I suppose, right, between him and Rachel Scotton, but yeah, it's like, either give us more or don't give us anything at all, because clearly this story is about defense. It's about this man. And, you know, the movie is almost, or is it over 2 hours?
Maybe like by 2 minutes.
Yeah. Okay. It's not quite 2 hours.
Okay.
Certainly doesn't need to be that long. Again, you know, this feels like a story that could be told in 90, you know, 96, 101 minutes, you know. You know, so there are some things that I don't love about this movie, but again, it's all about the Douglas performance. But speaking of the cast again, like, are these people just, they're like, yeah, I want to work with, you know, Joel. We love,
sure,
Joel.
Yeah.
And again, I don't know a ton. Obviously, I didn't know almost anything about Joel Schumacher. But, you know, I love that, you know, you got, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, Lois Smith as mom, Abby Rose Smith. We're not going to count him. He's just the writer. Michael Paul Chan, Raymond J. Barry. What a piece of shit in this movie. God.
Yeah.
D.W. Moffat. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, you know, 11 deep, you know, it's just people like, yeah, we love Joel. Of course I want to work with Joel.
Yeah.
Which I think is great. Now, speaking to Schumacher, I'm looking at his filmography. Would you consider him to be a journeyman director?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think he makes a specific kind of movie well. Which isn't to say that, like, how dare he make Falling Down? It just seems outside of what I think he traditionally does well. And I don't know how suited he is for the particular psychological and or moral complexities of the story he's telling.
Sure.
I think he ends up presenting a lot of it at face value. And I think, truth be told, I don't want to rewrite the movie or tell them what they should have done, but right, like, is this a stronger movie if it's just told through the Michael Douglas character's perspective? And then when we get to, wait, I'm the bad guy, that makes a little more sense, because this whole movie we've been bouncing back and forth, and we know he's the bad guy or whatever we want to call him, because we have the good guys who are trying to catch him.
Right.
And he's leaving a wake of death and destruction. And the Robert Duvall character doesn't seem to exist as a counterpoint to the Michael Douglas character.
Right.
So that's what I don't, again, it's totally watchable and all of it is compelling. It's just when I take a step back and say, why is this here, that I can't quite answer the question.
I wonder if, and I don't know much about Robert Duvall, but could it have been, you know, we have this story, most of it just follows this character defense,
right.
But oh my gosh, Robert Duvall wants to be in the movie. you know, let's give him a little more screen time. And so we're going to write some more junk for him just to be on screen with him.
And this is exactly what came up in last week's show on The Devil's Own, which has this same issue, which is like, oh, we got Harrison Ford. Now we have to write him apart.
Yes.
And so now we have two movies that converge at a certain point.
Right. Right. Yeah. No, I do like the idea of spending almost all the time, all of our time with defense, because even that line, as hard as it hits at the end, wait, I'm the bad guy, would hit even probably even harder, because we'd be like, yeah, of course you're the bad guy. Like, and then it'd be like, oh my gosh, like, holy shit, he doesn't realize what he's been doing. Yeah, I don't love how they treat the women characters in this movie. You know, they're sort of, you know, like how the cops, and, you know, maybe that's how it really is, but like how the cops, none of the cops, the men or the women cops, really believe anything Barbara Hershey's saying.
Right.
It's like, well, you know, I don't know, talk to your lawyer. Ma'am, did he beat you? Did he strike the child? No? What are we doing here then?
Right,
you know,
right.
Sort of thing. It's like, oh, shut the fuck up, dude. again, you know, and it's very much a product of its time. The LA riots broke out mid-production.
Oh, I read this, yeah.
And so, yeah, they had to move right to a back lot of a studio to film most of it. And so, you know, a lot, it does feel very, because like, I was very into watching the news coverage of the LA riots back then. And, you know, the OJ trial, the Rodney King thing, the, you know, the live footage of pulling the truck driver out right in that intersection and throwing the brick at his head. Like, it was everywhere. And I don't know, I felt very, you know, as a 10, 11, 12 year old kid, I was like, this is, oh my God, this is terrifying. This is life, watching Koreatown like go up in flames, right? Live on camera was so scary to watch. And so maybe, you know, this is just coming to me now. Maybe that's a reason why I love Falling Down so much, is because like that was such a moment in my life that like embedded itself, for better or worse, probably for worse, in me as a child, where like I was really shook by it. And maybe that's why I love Dark Blue so much. Again, a movie that isn't great, but I love it.
Dark Blue is pretty great.
I mean, you know, I'm a Ron Shelton fan. I'm a Kirk Douglas.
Yep.
Kurt Russell fan. I mean, what's not to love about it? Brendan Gleeson is a piece of shit in that movie. We should talk about Dark Blue.
That's a movie that is about LA at that time. And again, it has the advantage of hindsight, right? Because it's made 10 years after the fact. It's about the powder keg that was LA in the early 90s. Falling Down, like, could be that. But because they're making it in the middle of it all, I don't think they have the perspective. So instead of it being this movie about a powder keg, and elements of that are there, there's an anger that is underneath the whole movie. It's one of the better, like, hot movies I've ever seen in terms of, like,
such a sweaty movie.
Yeah. It feels orange, and like we're all getting skin cancer just during the movie. Predator 2, another great hot movie. Do the Right Thing, obviously the best hot movie ever made. But like, there's elements that are there for like, this is all under the surface, ready to explode. But when you drop the character of Defense into it, again, I don't think the movie understands who he is or what it's trying to say with him. I like the idea of like, he's this guy who's been rendered obsolete. You know, he's this guy who would have voted for Nixon, and now he's in 1990s Los Angeles and doesn't understand the world in which he lives. But then it tacks on like mental illness, And then it tacks on all these minor little frustrations and microaggressions, like the price of the soda at the convenience store. And it's like, it can't pick a lane in terms of who this guy is. And I just think it confuses the issue. I think in 2024, I look at defense and I'm like, oh, he would be MAGA now.
Oh, yes.
That's not great.
No, no. And see, that's like, we're going through this thing with my mom where she is, you know, she's old and doesn't understand a lot of, you know, things happening nowadays. And it's like, oh, okay, there's, you know, is it hopeless to try to explain, you know, certain things to her, or like try to get her to whatever, come around on things? So I was also kind of watching defense in that light. Now, a term that Jonathan Hertzberg from Fun City Edition says all the time about the movies that he releases, he likes to refer to them as out of time instead of ahead of time. Like, okay, he likes to, you know, these movies were kind of stood out from when they're released. I look at defense sort of like that. He's not necessarily stuck in the past. He's out of time, and he's confused. And this is not me defending defense or, you know, his actions or anyone like him in 2024. But he's scared and he doesn't understand, nor is he willing to understand the changed world. And I think it's interesting how, you know, he used to work for the defense department. And for me, when I hear the term defense department, I don't know why, but I like immediately think of like missile silos and like guys that work underground and like weren't allowed to like come out and be amongst the people. And so like, for me, defense sort of like fits that characterization perfectly. Like this guy who has been in this missile silo, like working on missile codes and designing all this shit for the U.S. military for so many years. And then all of a sudden he comes out into the real world and like the sun is extra bright and it's extra hot. And like he's in these clothes that he, you know, started wearing 30 years ago. And, you know, he's completely out of time, out of his element, and he's lost and he's confused. But then they like you said, they sort of like start mixing things up, like with the mental illness stuff.
Right,
and Barton
right.
Hirsch's character talks about, you know, he has this temper problem, and it's like, okay, pick a lane.
Right.
So I agree with you totally on that. You know, are we making Blast from the Past, or are we making a you know, like an Uwe Boll movie?
Well, it clearly wants, again, it wants to be Travis Bickle for the 90s.
Right.
Which it is in the conversation, you know. I mean, it's not Taxi Driver, obviously, but like, it's a descendant of Taxi Driver and a worthy descendant of Taxi Driver in a lot of ways. It just, again, I know when I went to see it as a kid, I thought it was like about this guy who snaps one day.
Right.
And it's not, because the movie then makes it a point of being like, oh no, he's been sick for a long time. And it's like, well then who is this guy? Even as a kid, I was like, I don't get that. And every time I come back to it, I butt up against those same issues, even though I find the movie watchable and compelling and interesting. You had asked earlier about like, is Joel Schumacher a journeyman? Like, this is an outlier. 8mm is an outlier. I've never seen The Number 23. I get the sense that that's an outlier when he tries to do like dark thriller. The rest of his filmography for the most part is like, yeah, that feels exactly like what I think a Joel Schumacher movie is. You know, he's this guy who starts out as a production designer. He moves into being a screenwriter, and then he starts directing. I just last night hosted a screening of Batman Forever, which is his first of the two Batman movies. And it's very entertaining. Like, that script is kind of garbage. I blame Akiva Goldsman because everything he touches kind of turns to garbage, except for some of the new Star Trek he's been doing. But like, I realized last night I've gotten everything I'm ever going to get out of the Tim Burton Batmans. And I kind of lean more towards the Schumachers these days, just because maybe I've seen them less, or because they're fun in a way and not brooding. Those actors deserved Oscars for saying those lines of dialogue, because holy shit, I'm watching that. So much of it just like washed over me because I was always watching it at home and watching it very loud on a big screen last night. I'm like paying attention. I'm like, do they know what the fuck they're saying right now? But so he was such a weird choice for Batman, but I like that he was just like, I'm going to go 180 degrees the opposite direction from what Tim Burton was doing.
Yeah.
I know people hate it. I get why people hate it. I think those movies have found an audience now, and I think people are finally kind of coming around to his movies. But like, I like a lot of his movies. I just don't know. And I like him as a person. Every interview I've ever seen with him, every commentary I've ever listened to, I'm just like, I'm pro Joel Schumacher, but I don't know that I've ever loved a movie because of the Joel Schumacher of it all.
Sure. Yeah. I completely agree with that. You know, I've seen, I don't know, let's see, rating highest first 10, 11, 12, you know, I've seen a dozen Schumachers.
Okay.
My least favorite would be Batman and Robin, but I love Batman Forever. Lost Boys, sure. One of my all-time favorites, yeah. Falling Down. Yeah. Love Flatliners.
Yeah, that's good.
It was Falling Down and Flatliners were the two movies right. We were deciding to do this podcast on.
Yeah.
You know, you got St. Elmo's Fire, which I like. But like, you know, that's why, like, I look at his filmography, it's like The Phantom of the Opera. Like, this guy, you know, has directed Phone Booth, all sorts of stuff.
St. Elmo's Fire to me feels like the text of Joel Schumacher, because it's about beautiful people looking great, and it's kind of about nothing.
Okay, and that makes sense.
Batman Forever, kind of the same thing. It's very concerned with surfaces.
Sure.
And I think Falling Down tries to be about something, and I think that's where it gets messy.
Oh,
because
yeah.
I don't think Joel Schumacher gets a handle on what he wants his movie to be about.
Well, their thing, like Falling Down is, in my opinion, a very ugly movie.
Yeah.
Like, especially early 90s, L.A.
Yeah.
The smog.
Yeah.
Like the real L.A., not Beverly Hills, not Hollywood, or, you know, the Hollywood right. of TV. You know, right. Hollywood is fucking trash heap, like if you drive through it now, but like it's not pretty. Falling right. Down I think does a good job at showing the ugliness of Los Angeles, but that, you know, Lost Boys about, you know, these very pretty young men, the Batman movies, you know, are very stylized. Phantom of the Opera, you know, about beautiful people, beautiful voices. You know, Phone Booth, it's all about Colin Farrell and his beautifulness. Flatliners, even, which I love, but like, you know, it's
and that movie looks great.
It looks awesome.
Yeah,
and it, you know, it, like the cast,
yeah,
is gorgeous. Mine, you know, maybe even. Well, I'll say it.
Don't you say something bad about Oliver Platt.
Oliver Platt is our teddy bear.
That's the movie that introduced me to Oliver Platt.
Probably me too.
Yeah. So. And now I probably like him more than any of the other actors in that movie, except maybe Kevin Bacon. I mean, not that I dislike anybody in that cast, but like when I see that Oliver Platt is in a movie, I'm like, oh, fuck yeah, it's on. Because he's,
you know,
amazing.
He's going to do something.
Yes.
Yeah. Taking chances. And, you know, I think speaking of taking chances, you know, that's another, and I've said it before, but another reason why I love this movie, Michael Douglas is doing something.
Yeah.
I remember watching the trailers, and the reason I thought, so when I said I finally got that snap case and watched the movie, and it was everything I wanted it to be. It was everything I wanted it to be, but it wasn't what I expected. I thought it was going to be like a one man army sort of commando because, you know, he starts out with the, you know, the glasses and the haircut,
right,
the tie,
right, right.
The white shirt. And then he, you know, gets the sort of, it's not befitting to Michael Douglas, but like that tactical oversized black thing that he's wearing. And I'm like, and then he's got the bazooka. Mm-hmm. I'm like, oh, fuck yeah. Like this is, and it's not that at all.
No.
And like it ends on a very, very down note. Now, okay. Hold on, I'm trying to pull up. I rarely take notes, but for some reason I took a few notes last night. So Robert Duvall's character's name is Prendergast.
Okay.
I feel like it was a typo. Somebody mispronounced it on a take, and they were just like, "Nah, just go with it." Prendergast. Like
we're stuck with it now.
It should be like Pendergrass,
right,
or something, right? Like that's the normal, but Prendergast, and like you could hear like a lot of people aren't saying Prendergrass; they're saying Pendergrass. That's like, are we just we're just going with it? We're going with the with
yeah.
The
you have to. Once somebody says it wrong, you're committed. They were shooting on film; that shit wasn't cheap.
That's right. Let's see here. The cops are terrible actors. Okay. So the whammy burger scene.
Yeah.
Which again, as terrifying as it would be in real life.
Yeah.
I think it's hysterical. I think Michael Douglas is very funny in that, but so like he pulls out the gun, everybody's freaking out. The old guy is trying to leave and he's like, no, sir, go back and sit down. And the guy goes and sits. Does he go back and sit at his chair? Because if that is his original seat, was he just going to leave his wife in? Like, there's a woman sitting there. So this man was just going to leave his wife.
It's a commentary on the fragility of men.
And see, that's another lane we're adding to fall down here.
It's about everything.
Right, exactly. Oh. How expensive is Barbara Hershey's house, do we think? I mean, it's a little worn down from being right on the beach, but beachside house property in Los Angeles, in Venice Beach.
Yeah.
I mean, it's
his defense contractor.
Defense
job
department. I was just gonna
did
say.
Did well. Yeah. He was fucking loaded.
Like he talks about how he has no more money. It's like, how do you not have any money? Like you, wasn't that a well-paying job? Don't you think that'd be a well-paying job?
Yeah. I don't know.
Whatever, man. I wanted to ask about your top three Schumachers.
Oh, shit. That's going to be nearly impossible.
I love that DC Cab is in there.
Lost Boys, Flatliners. We did a whole show on St. Elmo's Fire. That movie is not very good, but I could watch it anytime.
Same. Yes.
Yeah.
Pablo Sachs playing. I'm all about it.
Like, it really is like not a great movie. It's really some bullshit, but like I find it so watchable. Would I put it in my top three Schumachers? Maybe. 8mm might be in there. And 8mm is really the last. Phone Booth is good. I take it back. Phone Booth is kind of his last good movie because shit kind of falls off after that.
Yeah.
Although I haven't seen some of these. I haven't seen Blood Creek or 12.
Tigerland. Have you seen Tigerland?
I've seen Tigerland. Yeah, it's good. It's one of those movies that like Colin Farrell's really good, and I think it led to bigger things for him. But for a long time, I was so annoyed with Hollywood's insistence that Colin Farrell was a leading man. It's like, can you let me decide? Why do you keep insisting that he's the guy? And then eventually he becomes amazing and now right. he rules. But like, there was a while there where he was constantly being pushed on us. And I felt like Tigerland was part of that, but it's not really. It's in its own class.
Yeah, my high school girlfriend was obsessed with Colin Farrell. And like, you know, anytime he would appear on a talk show, she's like, you got to sit down and listen to this guy talk. And I'm like, fuck, so handsome. Quit looking at him. But yeah, I hated him just for that reason alone, because sure. my girlfriend was in love with him. But now I love him.
Yeah, he's awesome.
Great. Yeah, he's great.
So what are your top three?
I mean, Lost Boys, Falling Down, Flatliners.
Yeah.
I think, you know, nothing out of the ordinary. But I want to dig into some more Schumachers, like, you know, I haven't seen The Client or A Time to Kill. Maybe I probably saw A Time to Kill back when it came out, but I haven't seen it
since. Neither one is really great. I don't think I'm not a big Time to Kill guy, even though I know a lot of people would disagree with me, but I find that movie's politics very disturbing. And everyone is very sweaty in that movie. Like, yeah. It's his Tennessee Williams movie.
That's
for sure.
Well, yeah, that's what I remember it being, a very hot movie.
Yeah.
But I'm also a sucker for courtroom drama.
I usually am too. But for whatever, and I haven't seen Time to Kill in a long time, but at the time it did not work for me. As we've learned from Pain and Gain and 8mm and aspects of Falling Down, never give up on a movie. And so maybe Time to Kill is going to prove to be really great when I revisit it.
Yeah. Yeah. Can I ask your top three Douglas?
Oh, shit. Movies, performances, what are we talking about? It's going to have to be movies, because I don't know if I could decide his top three performances.
Yeah.
Romancing the Stone would be in there. American President would be in there. I'm trying to pull up his filmography. These are just off the top of my head. Where the fuck is his filmography? I went to his Wikipedia page instead of his IMDb page. This was a mistake.
I always have Letterboxd pulled up because it's easy to organize.
Much better. Okay, so... gosh. I mean...
I have Basic Instinct. It's a 4.5-star movie.
Oh, dear. Romancing the Stone, American President, maybe Wonder Boys?
I haven't seen Romancing the Stone since I was a kid. Never seen American President or Wonder Boys.
I can't. Wonder Boys is a legitimately great movie and a great Michael Douglas performance. American President, like, your mileage may vary. I that just is a movie that I love and can't totally defend. I think it's very good and very old fashioned, but I would never run around telling everyone, oh my God, you have to see The American President. But that was a movie that literally, like, TNT used to show movies twice in a row, and I would watch it both times. That's how much I love The American President.
I think I would love American President. I've Black Rain, Fatal Attraction, and Falling Down are my favorite Douglases.
And those are all good. Falling Down, I'm more mixed on than you, but Fatal Attraction obviously rules, and Black Rain rules. Last time I watched it, I was like, holy shit, this movie's so good.
Yeah, such an underrated Ridley Scott movie.
Yeah, like, for sure.
When people talk about Ridley Scott, it's like, you need to talk about Black Rain more.
Yeah. Well, I think with Ridley Scott, the thing is, like, he has movies that are so huge.
Yeah.
That people forget about some of the smaller ones, if we can call Black Rain smaller, you know?
Well, compared to some of the big ones.
Blade Runner and Alien and Gladiator and yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
I will say this about Falling Down, and then we should probably wrap up. Yep. I admire the fact that, like, in 1993, a movie like this could get made at Warner Brothers. Like, because for as much as it's imitating elements of Taxi Driver, there's still a lot of, like, 1970s in it. And it was a hit. This movie made like $100 million, which is wild to me because everything about it screams bomb to me. Watching it, I'm like, oh, this is a movie audiences would have rejected, but they did not. This movie made a lot of money.
Yeah, which is, I don't know, is that telling? Is that scary? Who knows? But yeah, you know, when it opened, it knocked Groundhog Day off the number one spot in the box office. And yeah, it is, this is one, you know, if they were to make it today, they would have to frame it differently, I think. And even a major studio would not release, you know, again, I feel like this is like a, oh God, I can't, you know, my old boss. It feels like a movie that he would release, right?
Yeah.
Like,
what's
the Vince Vaughn, Mel Gibson, Dragged Across Concrete sort of, where it's like, oh God, am I supposed to be like enjoying this or like, as much
that movie,
as I enjoy
that movie's
it,
super good, but like, yeah, the politics are messy.
Right. Yeah. Or like even like Cell Block, where I'm like, oh, fuck. Yeah, this movie is so fucking awesome, but is it, am I supposed to enjoy it? I don't know. Yeah, it's one of those where, and like, I kind of, when I was watching Falling Down last night, I was like, oh God, I really love this movie and I love Defense. All right. Michael Douglas's performance, not the character. Like, am I supposed to? I don't know. It's you know, it's messy, and I love a messy movie.
Yeah. On that note, we should wrap it up. But thank you for having such an interesting conversation about this movie.
My pleasure.
I don't know that I've come down on it one side or another, but that's okay. I'm just gonna live my life on the fence about Falling Down, and in a year I'll rewatch it and still not know how I feel about it, which is appropriate, I think.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's where this movie lives now.
Remember to go to our website every day, fthismovie.com, for cool movie shit. New podcasts every Wednesday. Reserve seating on Thursday at youtube.com/fthismovie. Read Anthony King's new column, Cult Corner, on Fridays at fthismovie.com.
Falling Down, a cult movie.
I would
include this. I would include this in the new volume. Yep.
Do you just kind of like, are you using any kind of measurement, or do you just kind of decide like, I think that's a cult movie?
Yeah. Sometimes like the one that will be coming out the Friday after this, like this week, is it's an older movie. And like, it's John Garfield's last movie. And to me, like, that automatically makes it a cult movie.
Okay.
Like, John Garfield is a cult figure because of the Blacklist shit. Yeah, there, you know, I have some metrics, but, you know, having done the Danny Perry podcast and like, you know, a devotee of his writings, I still read his essays constantly and reread them, you know, like, I kind of get a feel of what would, like, would Danny consider this a cult movie? And that's kind of what I'm trying to do.
Got it. Very cool. I've been enjoying it a lot. So thank you for writing that. Next week. Oh, I'm in Florida, but don't worry, because Hanging with Toby Hooper comes back and we're talking about The Fun House. So stay tuned for that. I love that movie.
My favorite Toby.
Mine too. Anyway, thanks again, Anthony. This was awesome.
Yeah, my pleasure. I had a great time. Thank you.
Thank you, everybody.
Thanks for listening to F This Movie.